Are you happy to tell us?
I'll fill it in, but I need volunteers first. Someone who relates to gravity in 113. Oh, come on. All right, we got one. That's why you raised your hand.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Your name is?
Abby.
Abby. All right, Abby's one. Come on up here, Abby. I need one other.
Oh, yay!
All right, so we have Abby, and you are?
James.
James. Okay, Abby and James. So we're going to see today which one of Abby or James really got the hang of gravity in Physics 113. All right? So what we have here is an aluminum tube. Abby, come here. Look in that tube and tell everybody what you see. It's just an empty tube. That's really all I want to verify. Yes. The tube is empty. Okay, so we have in the door next to Abby an empty tube. Okay? And then we have two pellets that can go down the tube. So I need somebody who has a stopwatch. Not a stopwatch, just a watch with a second hand. Alright. When you swallow, when you tell me your name. I'm practicing to be a waiter, so I'm going to learn to go up to people and say, "How's your dinner?" right when they shove a bunch of food. Maybe a whole lot of food, too. Alright. What I would like you to do, don't choke, is we're going to count down. You know, 3, 2, 1. And then Abby's going to drop this simple pellet down the tube. And when it hits to the bottom, it's going to hit a piece of metal. And so I would like you, with your fabulous fast reflexes, when we count down, you look at the time, and you try to estimate how much time it takes before it hits. Okay? So your time, yeah, the timer would be even better. Alright? Add it. Okay. Want to do a practice round?
Yes.
Alright, go for it.
Okay.
Alright. You ready? Alright. 3, 2, 1, go.
0.53
seconds. So we're good to the nearest 100. Alright. Now it's your turn. I'll do the same thing. All right. 3, 2, 1, go. Dude. How'd you do it one? What do you think?
8 seconds. 8.18 seconds.
You want to try that again?
Ready? 3, 2, 1.
What do you think?
Magic. It's always magic.
That's right. That's right. Last night I had too much coffee and I discovered an anti-grav. You were all be invited to Stockholm next October. No, sadly that was not what happened. Alright. There's one subtle difference between these two. This is yours. Would you read that?
Magnet.
They actually weigh the same. Same shape and everything. The one that Abby dropped has no magnet in it. And I forgot your name because I'm James. James. The one that James dropped has a magnet in it. This is a metal tube. Explain to me what's going on. You're not on the hook for that. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. However, you guys are on the hook for that. Any thoughts? What do you think?
As the magnet passes down through the tube and induces a current in the tube, as this magnetic field increasing as the magnet falls, as you progress down the tube, it induces a magnetic field opposite, which kind of acts as a repulsive force against gravity.
Awesome. I hope you all got that. It'll be a discussion question on exam 3. Let's slow it down a little. It's still sort of early for some of you, I imagine. Alright, magnet's going down. Magnet has magnetic flux coming out the wazoo, right? So as it goes down, you guys can have a seat. Thanks for having me. So as it goes down, you'll have a region of a conductor where you have an increasing magnetic flux going through it. You have an increasing magnetic flux going through it. It will induce a current, as if it's a current loop, in such a direction as to fight the change that creates it. So it will induce a current, which we call an eddy current, in this conductor that will create a field in the opposite direction of the one that's coming down. And so it actually acts like a magnet, basically pushing back, because it acts like it has an opposite pole, or the same sign of pole that is going the other way. And so that slows it down. The thing you expect to happen still basically happens, but you slow it down. There are actually braking systems in the real world that are built on this exact sort of phenomenon. You okay with that? Induction at work. Alright, so we're going to see some much cooler stuff with induction, though. So let me just remind you where we were last time. Last time we talked about certain elements called inductors. And inductors you can think of as little solenoids that when you put a changing current in them, they will have a magnetic field. So that there's an induced EMF if the magnetic field is changing because the current is changing, and that induced EMF is proportional to the changing current, and that constant proportionality is called the constant of inductance, or L. Charge these up Thursday. It's not going to work. Right. So if I do Kirchhoff's law going across around the circuit, I go across, I have an epsilon, forget one power of I on all of these initially. I have a voltage drop of IR here, so that would be IR. And then I would have an EMF induced across this inductor that would go as L times DI over DT. I then multiply all three terms by an I, because when I do that, I can sort of identify what each of them represents. This is VI, this is the power generated by the battery. I squared R is a power term for energy loss in a resistor. Then if those are both power, then this one is going to be the power that's going into the inductor. And so that's sort of the form of this term. So then we can look at a solenoid and look at this power, and we can take that power and divide it by, look at its energy per time, and from that we're able to derive the amount of energy that's in the inductor is 1/2 Li squared, and then look at the volume in a standard solenoid and extract how much energy is in the magnetic field per unit volume, or the energy density in the magnetic field. And what we found is it depends on the magnetic field magnitude and this constant mu zero, but this really is independent of the geometry and everything. So what we found is that the magnetic field itself, this strange sort of fictitious thing that we invented in order to describe what's going on, also carries energy. Okay, and the term is very similar to what we found for the electric field. So last time it was a little bit of a disjoint class. I hope this one will be a little bit better. But another thing we discussed, because I wanted to talk about magnetic fields and materials, is something called the magnetic moment. And the magnetic moment we define as the B field times A, where this B field is the B field produced by a current loop. And that would be the magnetic moment. If we have an external magnetic field, so I represent the B produced by this loop as sort of coming up here through. And the flux will rotate around. So if you're able to measure the field, the flux going through the loop due to the current itself, then you would get something known as a magnetic moment. And it will have a direction, because the B field coming up through it will have a direction. If I flip this loop over, the B field will be going the other way. So it basically does have that, it has a vector characteristic. If I now put that in an external magnetic field, I didn't derive it for you, but there is a torque that exists on this loop which tries to align this mu with B. So it's mu cross B, but it basically acts to rotate the plane of this loop so that the magnetic moment is lined up with the external magnetic field. Okay, so this is a classical interaction. It certainly exists very much in quantum mechanics, but there you have a state of a certain configuration, and then if you supply just the right amount of energy, it might change its orientation. So that would be something very similar to what you see with magnetic resonance and such. So we'll come back to this, but this would be the classical picture where it would be a smooth torque. It's not necessarily doing quantum jumps. That said, then I want to spend a little time talking about magnetism and materials. So you can imagine that materials are made up of, it turns out when you want to talk about magnetic characteristics, you really come out with three different primary categories. One is called paramagnetic materials. And in paramagnetic materials, you consider the materials to be made up of atoms or molecules that actually have an inherent little magnetic moment. You can think of them as little bar magnets, okay? They have random orientations typically in the material because you have a lot of thermal excitation and things will just be moving around. So these would be natural dipoles. If you have a paramagnetic material and you put it in an external magnetic field, because you have these little magnetic dipoles naturally and you have this torque that's trying to align these dipoles with the magnetic field, you will begin to align these dipoles with the magnetic field. They will not all line up perfectly because they are weak dipoles for the most part, and because there is a lot of thermal agitation and crap that goes on in materials because that's how they are. And what you find, though, is that the stronger the magnetic field you have externally, the larger the fraction of these magnetic dipoles that you'll actually line up. So we'll find a constant of proportionality where if we put an external field on a paramagnetic material, we will actually be increasing the magnetic field inside the material relative to the external field. Because what happens is this field gets added with the field of all the little dipoles that are lining up. Stronger field, more of those dipoles will line up. So there's sort of a proportionality there. Then there is another type of material, and this is a little bit bizarre, and this is one where the material itself has no inherent dipoles in it. However, when you put an external magnetic field, it will induce magnetic dipoles in an orientation that is opposite the field. And you can at least mentally think of this a little bit like Lenz's law at work, where if I have something and I have an increasing magnetic field that causes an increasing flux, you may induce currents in such a direction as to fight that flux. So you can think of this material being made up of loops of wire that are not carrying current, and then I turn on a magnetic field in a certain direction, and then you will induce little dipoles that will fight that change, so they'll be opposite in direction. The picture breaks down because if this B field is constant, I will still have these induced dipoles. So it doesn't really fit that mental model perfectly. That mental model really is only works in a sense when you're turning on the field. So there's more at work there, which we're not going to dig into. But what happens with the diamagnetic material is you have little dipoles that are induced in a direction such that their field is opposite of that of the external field. Again, the stronger the external field, the more of these dipoles you may produce. But it is less of an effect than you have in your typical paramagnetic thing. But what happens here is, in fact, inside this material, the field is weaker than it is externally in this case. So it's a little bit like you have anti-magnetism going on inside that material. Think about that. Okay, those are called diamagnetic materials. And then there are materials which are called ferromagnetic materials, and the classic example is iron. And here you have many unpaired electrons in the atomic orbitals of the atom, and these give the iron nucleus a large magnetic moment. And it's large enough that the iron nuclei and the way in which the iron lattice works, it is such that they basically will talk to each other and they will align atom to atom. And what happens within the actual iron lattice is you will have local regions of iron dipole alignment. These typically are called domains. If you look at the material as a whole, very often those domains may be in basically random directions. If you now put a magnetic field on a ferromagnetic material, you do cause a torque on the dipoles, and you will begin to align regions of the dipoles. These domains will begin to line up along the direction of the magnetic field. And in this case, you will get a stronger magnetic field. The field here is going to be added to by the field of all of these things. So when I talk about inside the material here, you're strengthening the field a little bit overall because you're basically putting all these little dipoles in. So it's in this whole region. So if I do this, I'm strengthening the field also outside of it because the flux of all these also has to go out into the space around it. But what happens here is the effect is much larger because of the way the lattice structure is, you'll get more of them to align. And because they all have fairly large magnetic moments themselves, it's like you get a lot of bar magnets here. Again, you will not necessarily get perfect alignment, but the effect here is much bigger. So these are sort of the three main types of materials where magnetism is concerned. Any questions on any of those? All right, I want to talk a bit more about the ferromagnetic materials, because there are some aspects of it that I think you should understand. Magnetism turns out to be something that's very useful in any of the diagnostic instruments that you use in chemistry and medicine. And there are some things that characteristics, both cost, design, and the way in which you have to use them, that is driven by the way in which the magnetism is set up. So let me spend a moment doing that. Well, okay, before I come back to... before I get into ferromagnetism at that level, let me actually talk a little bit more about the magnetism in general. Then we'll come back to ferromagnetism. So there is a dependence, which is this, you know, you begin to align more of these dipoles or these anti-dipoles or these anti-aligned dipoles, depending on the strength of the magnetic field. And we quantify that in magnetism by the following expression. The magnetic field inside the material is equal to mu zero times 1 plus a quantity called I sub m times B3. This B3 would be a way to think of this as the external field. This would be the magnetic field you would have if there was no material there. This constant is something that we call the magnetic susceptibility. And it gets a symbol K sub M. And K sub M can be positive or negative. If it is positive, then you have a paramagnetic material. If it is negative, you'll have a diamagnetic material. If it's positive, then the field that you experience on the left is larger than the external field that's in the material. If it's negative, then the field you get on the left is going to be smaller than B3. Okay? So you can imagine having a table of magnetic susceptibilities, which allows you to quantify this for every material. But I think you'll all agree that would be vastly too simple. Nobody's going to preserve their job if all you have to do is look up a table and know what it does to the magnetic field. So, we can't have that. So our way around that is to take this quantity and we call that quantity the relative permeability. And the astute among you will look at that and go, they're sort of just one to one. And they are. They just have different names. So you add 1 to the magnetic susceptibility and you get a different quantity called the relative permeability. And we can take B becomes mu zero plus mu zero times chi m times this B free. And we can define this mu zero chi m is just the permeability. So you can sort of think of mu zero chi m a little bit like how in electromagnetism you have epsilon naught, the permittivity of free space, and then epsilon naught times whatever it was, k, the permittivity of the material. Here we have this mu zero, that is the permeability of free space, times this constant chi sub m, which may be a bit bigger than 1 or a bit less than 1, that we call just the straight up permeability of the material. And again, every material will have a permeability, or it will have a relative permeability, or it will have all three of these, and they're basically all one-to-one and tied together. I'm sort of dragging you through this because you could see it any of the three ways. If I were emperor, I would eliminate two of them. But I'm not, so you're stuck. Sorry. But I hope you get the idea. So chi m could be bigger or less than 1. Actually, it can be, so if you have chi m approximately greater than almost equal to 1, then you would have a paramagnetic material. If you have it much, much greater than 1, then you have a ferromagnetic material, because it makes the field much stronger. And if you have chi m less than 1, then you'd have a diamagnetic material. Okay? Alright, so what I'd like to do for the moment, though, is to talk about ferromagnetism. And the reason I want to talk about ferromagnetism is that ferromagnetism is used in general to give you the best magnets that you'll have in a lab that are cost effective. So there are ways to create pretty powerful magnets in the lab. One way is you just create a current loop. And you just shove a bunch of current in there, and as you know, that'll create a magnetic field. And that works fine. The problem with that is if you do that with regular wire, it has resistance, which means there's power loss. So the thing gets hot, you have temperature changes. It's sometimes a little bit hard to maintain control over the exact strength and shape of the field because it's going to fluctuate a little with the current or, you know, whatever. There's a lot of problems, but the main thing is there's going to be power loss. If you're running this magnet all the time and you have high field, it's going to be a very, very expensive thing to do. So one way around that is to take a whole bunch of upfront costs and you create this magnet out of something which is called a superconductor. So it's a material that allows you to run a current through it that has no resistance. The problem with typical superconductors that you can use to make magnets is that they tend to run at temperatures that are close to absolute zero, so you basically have to cool them with liquid helium, and that becomes extremely expensive in terms of upfront cost. But you will find in hospitals and such, you'll find instruments that have superconducting magnets in part because they overall cuts the cost way down. But there's this huge upfront cost and continuing cost of sort of maintaining the cooling plant and things like that for the superconducting magnet. Often, if you see a superconducting magnet, one of the reasons you'll see it is because they want a very high field. If the field is less than about 2 teslas, so that's 2,000 gauss, very often the magnet will be made up of a chunk of iron with a current loop around it. If I take the iron away, then I have to create the field purely out of the current that I get in the current loop. It takes a lot of power. If I have a chunk of iron in there, I can have a much smaller field, and I align the domains in the iron, and I get a much stronger field just because the iron is there. So it's as if I get a free magnetic field, in a sense, for relatively little current. So long as you want to have an instrument that uses a magnetic field that is less than about 2 tesla, it probably makes sense to make it out of an iron core. So very often in instruments, you'll see some big chunk of iron coming out, and some other chunk of iron coming out, and there's this region where they have flat tips or something like that. And this region will have a very uniform and strong field, but that field is going to be 2 tesla-ish or less, typically. Okay? And so, okay. So if you're actually running one of these instruments, you'll find that there's some sort of strange behavior to it that you have to take into account. So let us suppose we look at the magnetic field that we have in the iron, which basically is also the field that's going to penetrate out at the tip of the iron. And let's look at how it would look relative to the external field that I have around the iron. So let's suppose that I start off with iron that I have alloyed, I've made iron and steel, right? So I basically take the steel and I cool it down, but it's been quite hot. So what will happen then is I'll have a lot of local domains that have sort of random orientations. So what that would mean, if I have such a chunk of iron, then I would start out with effectively zero field inside the iron. So I'm going to start out right here. As I turn on an external field, within the region of the iron, I'll have a magnetic field, which is due to the external field, superimposed with the field that I get as I begin to align some of these domains. So what will happen is I'll begin to get stronger field, but it will have a slope because the stronger this field is, I also am adding to it aligned domains, so this slope is bigger than one. That is, for a given field strength here, I'll have a much stronger field strength there. So as it goes, it'll begin to grow like that, okay? It's much stronger. That's sort of the free field effect I'm talking about. As I continue to get stronger, I will have fewer and fewer unaligned domains joining in. So this effect will sort of lessen. In fact, it will asymptotically stop. So as I go to a stronger field, I'll begin to asymptotically level off. And this will happen at a field strength of about 2 tesla. If I now reverse the field, or I begin, instead of growing it, I begin to reduce it in strength once I have it up there saturated. Okay, so I have all the domains saturated. Then what will happen is there will be some lag. The external field will get weaker, but I'll still have these various domains talking to each other, and they'll sort of work to keep each other aligned. So you won't become unaligned in the same way that you became aligned. So you'll end up with some weird effect like this field coming back. Like so. Which means when I have the external field and I cross zero with it, so I've turned it off, I still have a significant magnetic field in the magnet. That's permanent magnetism, right? If I now take that magnet away, I have what you would call a permanent magnet. It just has these aligned domains and it has a magnetic field in it, even though there's no external field. Okay? I now have this effect of permanent magnet sitting here, and now I reverse the direction of B3. So I go from a positive that's going one way, I now reverse it. So it's going to have to start unaligning some of these domains. And it does. But it has that lag because it's basically now a permanent direction going the other way. So it'll come... Ooh. I didn't mean to do that. So it'll come down something like this. And then in the opposite direction, eventually you start aligning the domains the opposite way and you come back and you'll have the same type of effect, but now the field is going the other way at a strength of about 2 tesla. Now, something like this. And then there's a symmetry. If I reverse the field again, it would come back like that. This thing is called a hysteresis loop. And if I have a chunk of iron that isn't a very precise instrument, like a nuclear magnetic spectrometer or something like that. And I really need to know very precisely what that magnetic field is. If it is made of iron, which many of them may be, then if I just have the chunk of iron there, I actually have no clue what the magnetic field is. Because I really don't know what the history of that iron is. And how much of it is permanently magnetized one direction or other, I really don't know. So the only way that I can control that if I want to have a precision instrument is to literally take it and turn the current up around it to force it to full saturation and reverse it. And once I have basically saturated it completely and then reversed it and I'm on this curve, basically, then I can figure out where I am on the curve and put it exactly where I want it and know exactly what the field is. So you may find if you're using such an instrument, you have to go through this really weird procedure of bringing the current way up and then way back the other way or something as you go through this so-called hysteresis loop calibration sort of thing. So, anyway, practical education for the day. Any questions on this? So I have a page in the slides where I sort of lay out all those various pieces that we just went through, so I won't bother going through it again, but this will allow you to come back to it if you want. Okay? You good with that? If you want to go to really, really, really high fields in the lab, then you basically want to have currents that will melt or destroy whatever it is you use carrying the current. So if you want to do experiments that have extraordinarily high fields, in fact, you can do them, and I forget what the record is, but it's really high, I mean, like 100 Tesla or something. You can do it, but it's basically explosive. So you have to set up the experiment, and then you have so much current and things going in that the whole thing just explodes and is destroyed. So you can do that, but you now have to have really fast diagnostics and stuff like that. So that's the kind of game they play at, say, the National High Magnetic Field Lab in Tallahassee, Florida, or something like that. So people do look at magnetic effects on materials and living things and stuff like that at really, really high fields, but it's hard to do. Very often, as they go to really high fields, it's a fast process, and you can't repeat it with that sample, sort of, because it gets destroyed. So, okay? All right. Don't know if you can see it, but I have a bunch of coils of wire, just a coil of wire here, a big set of coils. I don't know how many turns it is, a lot. I have it plugged directly into the wall socket. Okay? So we won't worry about the fact that in the wall it's AC, which means the EMF is going one way to the other way. So in reality, this will create a current that's going one way and then another way. So there's a lot of change in direction and everything. But that said, we can think of it as DC for a moment. And so at the moment it has zero current because I have the field off. And then when I turn it on, it'll create a nice magnetic field due to these loops. And then I have a chunk of iron that is shoved straight down through those loops. But the purpose the iron serves is to amplify that field dramatically. So I get a much stronger magnetic field in this region of space due to the fact that I have the iron. Okay. So here I have a simple conducting circle. But this circle has a gap in it. Okay, you probably can't see it. There's a gap, right? So there's a little slip, so it is not a complete circle. I put it around the piece of iron. I turn the current on. Nothing happens. I have an identical loop, except now there's no gap in it. I turn the current on. Something happens. Alright. Actually, I forgot to ask. If I have some liquid nitrogen and cool it way down, it goes almost to the ceiling. So what's going on? I have a gap. I have a massively changing electromagnetic field through this region of space. It will induce a current that fights it, except that current can't go around the circle, so it doesn't really do anything exciting. Okay? I have a full ring, and I put it here. I have a massively changing magnetic flux, which induces a current that fights it. The current that fights it effectively creates a magnetic pole going the other way, which is what kicks out the exact same effect as what we have here, just sort of a different setting. Okay? So it's induction at work. It's cool, right? It's the same as that demo, but I have to do it because it's too cool. Alright. So there you have it. That's basically it for electromagnetism. You've now seen almost all of it. So what I'd like to do next is to actually just pull together what we already know. Okay? And we're going to add one little piece. And when we do, then we're going to have what's known as Maxwell's equations. Named after this guy, James Clerk Maxwell. And if you go out into the world and you say, you know, who's the most fabulous, brilliant, amazing physicist that's ever lived, probably most people would say Einstein. Some people might say Stephen Hawking. But if you ask physicists, they'll also probably say Einstein. But many of them will tell you James Clerk Maxwell. He did a lot of really amazing stuff. And probably none of them would put Hawking up in Einstein and Maxwell's category. They're pretty much there by themselves. All right, so let's just, you know, what have we done? Either somebody's using a bandsaw or they're torturing a cat. I don't know. All right, so what we know is that the integral of E dot dA around some surface is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. And we call this Gauss's law. We also know that there exists no thing such as a point source of magnetism. So if we think about Gauss's law, we have this Q enclosed bit. That is the source of the field flux going through the surface. Okay, so the field lines have to start or end on the electrical point charges, right? So a physicist would call those the electric monopoles. That is, they're point sources. They're like water coming out of the faucet or down a sink or something. In magnetism, we don't have that. We have there exists no such thing as a magnetic monopole that we have discovered. Which means when you do the same kind of derivation that we tried, that we did with Gauss's law, to see what happens with magnetism, that is, I make a surface and I ask how much flux penetrates through and what is that equal to, you will always get zero. Because if I have anything that creates magnetic flux inside that surface, it has magnetic field lines going out one way and they have to come back in the other way. And they cancel out. So there is something we haven't bothered to study because it's not terribly useful to us. So this is over a surface. This would be over a surface. The integral of B dot dA, calculated the same way you would E dot dA, is equal to zero. That is a statement that there exists no... magnetic point sources, or as a physicist would say, monopoles. Then we had a law where we do an integral around a curve, so I put a C of B dot dl, and that's equal to mu zero times I enclosed. And this is what we call Ampere's law. And then we had a law where we looked at the integral around a curve of E dot dl. And we found that that was equal to minus d phi m over dt, which is equal to minus d over dt of the integral around the surface of that curve, B dot dA. And this was what we call Faraday's law. All right, so you good with all that? That's what we've studied so far. Maxwell became bothered by one little aspect of one of these equations that he felt fell short of a complete understanding. So let's imagine let's look at Faraday's law for a moment. Remember what Faraday says is that if I have some current, or well, I'm sorry, it's Ampere's law that we need to look at. I have some current that's going topologically through this curve. It will induce a magnetic field sort of circulates around that wire. That gives us a non-zero B dot dl as we add up the dls and the b's around the wire. That is equal to this mu zero times the I enclosed for the I that penetrates through that. Okay? And when we talk about it that way, we have a picture in mind. And the picture that we have in mind is that we basically have a piece of gauze around that loop. And we're talking about current that actually penetrates through that gauze. Okay, so we think of that loop as all being in a plane. It turns out mathematically that's not quite right. That is sort of right, but what we're really talking about for flux is how much of the magnetic field penetrates through the surface that this curve the curve surrounds, okay? So any surface that this curve basically closes is the edge to should work. So if that surface is basically like a pie plate or something here, or plate, then our picture makes complete sense. But you can concoct an example of a case where this doesn't quite work. Suppose that I have a current carrying wire that ends in a capacitive plate, and I have a gap, and I have another capacitive plate here with its wire coming out this way, and I have a nice current like so. And now I put my curve here, just like we have on the other one. Okay. Now I can look at it just like we did a moment ago. I can imagine this curve as basically being the surface of a frisbee or a plate, and the curve is the rim of the plate, and I have this current going through that plate, and Ampere's laws, we have it up here, works just fine. But I can be a little bit perverse with this. The mathematics allows me to do it. And what it allows me to do is to imagine the surface that is inside the curve looks more like a chef's hat than a pie plate. So I can imagine that its surface looks something weird like this. And if I construct the surface like that, and I consider that surface, there's no current that passes through it, because the surface is constructed to pass through this region where there's no current. Okay. So that may seem, certainly should seem, like a subtlety. I mean, it is a subtle thing. But it turns out that this integral on the left-hand side encompasses both of these cases. So Maxwell noticed this and he thought, this law is incomplete. We need to plug this hole because there's this topology that doesn't work. And we need to be able to make it work because we know, for example, I could do an experiment where I have such a gap. And in fact, I will have an E dot DL induced. I'll get an induced EMF around that curve. I'm sorry, I will get a... I will get a magnetic field around this curve regardless of whether I have the gap or not when I have the current running. So I know that the right-hand case has to work. So Maxwell modified Ampere's law in the following way. So he has one term that is what we're used to seeing, and he added a new term. And the new term has a couple of constants in it, but it has E dot dA. It has the electric flux that passes through the surface that is formed by this curve. So if you stop and think about it, in this region, if I have a current here, I'm building up charge on these plates. That means the electric field in this region is changing. And I have a flux that goes through this surface, which is now this sort of weird rounded surface. But the electric flux is changing and growing as I have the current here because I'm building up charge there. So he added a term that gives a contribution to this integral if you have the electric flux in this region increasing. And that's what this is. This is the electric flux, and what he's saying is that if I have a current here, I will have that changing with time, and I have a contribution. So this plugs the hole. I now have a situation where I have just what we had with Ampere's law that worked so well here when we thought about it. We invent this new weird topology, and Maxwell added a term that basically now takes into account this topology. You don't have to worry about this term if you're only considering something here because there's no electric flux passing through. But when you have this kind of thing you're considering, you have this electric flux. Okay? Do you really care? You do. You may not know it yet, but you really do. And here's why. This term brings out some very important, it brings out something that's really important when you look at all these equations together. So what I'd like to do is to think about that for a moment. Oh, never mind. All right, so we have these, and now what I'd like to do is to add this term in. This is the new version of Ampere. Just for completeness, I won't worry about it, but this term that we've been talking about, this term, we call Maxwell's displacement current. You call it a current because you're using it as if you were making a current here, but it's not really a current. I mean, sort of a weird thing. So we call it a displacement current. I don't know what your book calls it, but I want to at least mention that. Let's imagine that we are in a region of space that has no current. Okay, so if we're in a region of space that has no current, just for a simpler case, you need this for the complete Maxwell's equations, so I'm going to erase that term for the moment. And we'll say we have no current there. Let me erase this complication for a moment. And the reason I'm doing this is I hope maybe it begins to make the symmetry equations a little more clear. Notice in these equations that you have some degree of symmetry between the E and the D. Integral of E dot dA is this Q enclosed over epsilon naught. Integral of B dot dA is zero. If we lived in a world where we had magnetic monopoles, in fact, you would have a term here that's equivalent to that. It'd be the magnetic monopoles enclosed. And then you would have a perfect symmetry in these equations. Here's an integral of B dot dl is a change in some electric flux. Integral of E dot dl is change in magnetic flux. So these are actually quite symmetric. The fact that you don't see full symmetry in these equations is important enough that many physicists have spent their careers looking for magnetic monopoles. When people say art, that science doesn't have art and it's not aesthetic, that is so bullshit. Okay? And when you do an experiment and you're trying to figure out what your systematic errors are, you'll come back and say, yeah, boy, that is so true. You do often go with your gut in science. You do the best you can to be as quantitative as possible. But things like, for some reason that we don't fully appreciate, often nature seems to work in a way that gives us beautiful equations. And this is an example of it. These equations are almost beautiful. And they would be really beautiful if we had magnetic monopoles. So people have gone off looking for magnetic monopoles because we have no a priori reason for them not to exist. And in fact, in most cosmological theories, the string theorists will tell you that they do exist. But something happened in the early stages of the universe. There was a period of inflation where we had magnetic monopoles in our universe, but the universe became so big so fast that basically the density of magnetic monopoles dropped to zero in the world in which we can sample. So they sort of went away. But they are still sort of thought to be able to exist. But that's a different class. At any rate, what I wanted to point out was that these equations have almost perfect symmetry, okay? That said, they're still pretty. I mean, most physicists would look at this and go, they're actually quite nice. Let me take you on a tour of a little piece of this as to why it's sort of cool. What you'll notice here, let's look at these two equations. There's a different form. I'll write it for you next time. I'm not going to make you understand it. There's a way to mathematically write this, which is called, this is called the integral form of Maxwell's equations. You can rewrite them in a different form called the differential form of Maxwell's equations, and some of this is a little bit easier to see with that, but I'm not going to drag you through that. Let's just look at this. These turn out to be two coupled differential equations. Differential because you have this thing changing in time. Coupled because I have a changing electric field in space, it produces a B field. If I have a B field in space that's changing, I get an E field. So these things are sort of coupled together. Okay? So what they're telling you is that a changing E field induces a magnetic field, and a changing magnetic field induces an electric field. So if I have a wad of charge and I have it in space and I'm changing the field by wiggling it, for example, I take this charge and I accelerate it downward. In this space, I have a changing electric flux with time. If I have a changing electric flux with time, then we know that if I do a curve around that space, then B dot dl is not zero. I've created a B dot dl according to this equation, okay? It's changing because this flux is also changing. So the B that I get is changing as that flux is changing. If I have a changing magnetic field in this region of space, then I can draw a curve around that, and I'll have a changing electric field. I'll have an electric field with it. The directionality isn't obvious here, but it effectively will turn out as basically at right angles to each other. So these things are coupled together and sort of self-propagate. So if I take charge and I wiggle it, it produces a magnetic field at right angles to that. That magnetic field is changing because the E field is changing. If I have a changing magnetic field in space, it induces an electric field at right angles to that. That electric field is changing because the B field is changing. If I have an electric field in space that's changing, I get the B field. If I have the B field changing, I get an E field. And it propagates outward. We can take these equations and deconstruct them, which is an exercise I'm not going to force you to go through. I'm not going to do for you. It's a beautiful thing, but I only drag physics majors mostly through it. If we deconstruct them, what we would find is that when you take these two equations, they each represent wave equations for E and for B separately. So if I were to take this self-propagating weirdness of E and B, okay, and I look at just the solution for E or just the solution for B, it would look just like a wave equation, effectively, of a wave traveling on the string. Okay? Now, you know from waves traveling on strings that one of the characteristics of these things is they travel with a speed. Or another way to say it is, I wiggle the charge and I have the E and the B inducing each other, and this whole effect propagates outward. And if you look at these equations and you extract the wave equations, you can actually determine the speed with which the waves propagate. And they propagate with the speed of light. And that is the essence of light. And when Natsuo figured that out, it had to be the coolest moment any human has ever experienced, I think. Generally, when we say white, often what we really mean is visible light. So more generally, these are called electromagnetic waves because they propagate outward with a certain speed, but I can govern the nature of the wave, that is the frequency with which the fields are oscillating, by how fast I wiggle the charge, basically. If I wiggle it slowly, then you end up with these fields changing slowly. If I wiggle it very fast, then they can change very fast. And so these are electromagnetic waves of different frequencies. So if it's wiggled at a certain speed, you get visible light. You go a little faster, you get ultraviolet light. You go a little slower, you get infrared. You go way slow, you get radio. You go way fast, you get gamma rays. Okay, and so how these things, the energy they carry, which we haven't talked about yet so much, and how they interact with matter depends very much on the energy they carry and sort of what the wavelength is. And you get lots of weird characteristics. We'll see when we look at optics. If the wavelength you're using is much longer than the thing you're trying to image, you can't image it. If your wavelength is shorter, you can image it. So, for example, for an optical microscope, there's a limit to the size that you can image things, right? So you go to electron microscope. So we got a lot of fun stuff to cover. So we get a rich spectrum of so-called electromagnetic waves, and I want to study the characteristics of those. Let me think about the order in which I want to do this. So I'm skipping a lot of the math for you, and I'm just going to give you implications of what comes out of these equations. It isn't part of this class to take these equations and extract what I'm about to show you. I expect you to know what comes out of it, so the characteristics of electromagnetic waves. If you're really interested in seeing how those characteristics are extracted from those equations that we have now seen, that's sort of a different thing. I can point you to sources, or I can send you through, or I can take you through it in 20 minutes, but it's not something that we're going to do in this class. But let's take a very particular example. Maxwell's equations as a whole are always true. They are the core of what makes electromagnetism electromagnetism. What I'd like to do is to look at a very specific case right now of solution to Maxwell's equations, and that specific case is one where I have a source of light that is very, very far away. So the light is doing its thing, and we're going to be very, very far away and effectively looking at the light as it comes through, and I'll have a coordinate system like so. And we're also going to specifically say that we wiggle the charge in a certain direction. So I could be free to do it in any direction I want. I'm going to do it in one specific direction, again, for simplicity. So what we're going to say is if we look at the electric field that passes a certain piece of space, I think to get to the point that I want to get to, I don't have time. So I'm going to stop now and start this.